As false and not identify oneself with that body, then certainly an awake person need not identify with the gross body. As one who is awake has no connection with the activities of the body in the dream, an awakened, liberated soul has no connection with the activities of the present body. In other words, because he is acquainted with his constitutional position, he never accepts the bodily concept of life.
श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपकदाम्बर्यं ददाति स्वापदातिकम् वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरुं श्रीयुतः पदकमलं श्रीगुरुं वैष्णवांश्च श्रीगुरुकं साग्रजातां सहगणा रघुनाथामुदकमलं सजीवम् साद्वैतं सावलोकितं परिजनासहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधां कृष्णपदां सहगणाधृता श्रीविशाखामृतमश्च हे कृष्णवर्णासिन्धु दीनबन्धो जगत्पते गोपेश
Because intelligence is the one that really creates doubts. Srila Prabhupada always talk about how it is very important for devotees to have doubts. But beyond a certain stage, those very doubts become the cause of our problems in devotional service. If you just didn't have doubts, what's the problem? Like a few days back, one devotee came up to me and he said, Prabhuji, and he's been practicing for many, many years on 16 rounds, 400 principles on the initiation list, and I mean, they're like a good standing devotee. He came up to me one day and he said, Prabhuji, sometimes I feel all this, you know, Krishna consciousness, and this Krishna's pastime, and this and that, I feel sometimes it's all made up stories. So, wow, that's buddhi, you know, that's intelligence in action. Sometimes our intelligence overanalyzes and brings up some crazy things. How do you deal with this? How do you deal with the intelligence? In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaks about this very interesting verse. He says, Tesham Satatyuktanam Bhajatam Priti Purvakam Nadami Buddhi Yogutam Enamam Priyantite. And then he speaks about this very important concept in the Shavishloka Gita about Buddha Bhava Samandita. Which was it there? Machitta Madhula Prana Bodhayam Parasparam Katyantashtya Mahamityam Kushyanti Charamantisha. And then, what is the meaning of this word, Buddha Bhava Samamita? He speaks about Buddha essentially means buddhi or intelligence, and Bhava means emotions, or we call it faith, we call it Vishwas. So these are two things that every devotee in his life really needs to balance, buddhi and Vishwas. Intelligence and faith, emotions, devotion. So, bhakti is about a balance between the two. There are many faults with buddhi. Like one very exalted devotee, he prayed, My dear Lord, please take away my buddhi. Very interesting prayer, you know. So, there's a very interesting leela of connected with Lord Shiva, the Shivaratri in Australia. Speak about Lord Shiva a little bit. So Lord Shiva is very famous for chopping off heads. He chopped off three heads. Chopped off the head of Lord Brahma, fifth head of Brahma. He chopped off the head of Lord Ganesh, and he chopped off the head of Daksha Prajapati. So if you just see from, you know, one point of view, you say, what is this? And Shiva just chopping off people's heads, left, right, center. You see on a chopping spree, you know. There's a solid analysis of why he chops off heads. And all the heads that he chops off are all connected with buddhi. So the head is the seat of intelligence, right? So Brahma is a god of buddhi. In fact, this Srimad Bhagavatam mentions that all of us are made up of earth, water, fire, air, ether, okay, you know, different elements. Mind, intelligence, force, ego. Brahmaji is made up of only one element, intelligence. Can you imagine? The whole body of Brahma is only made up of one substance, that is intelligence, buddhi. You can imagine how intelligent he'll be. On top of that, he has so many heads, you know. So naturally, he is the most intelligent person in the world. Daksha is the son of Brahma. And Daksha means expert or clever. And Daksha can be born when there is Daksha is byproduct of intelligence. Naturally, he is the most intelligent person in the world also. So when it came to the marriage of Sati, Daksha's daughter, naturally, Sati also personifies buddhi or intelligence. So, Daksha went to Brahmaji, his father, and he asked him that, who should I marry my daughter to? And Brahmaji said, marry your daughter to Lord Shiva, who represents Vishwas, faith. Parvati Devi, when she asks Lord Shiva, What is that thing that is the topmost according to you? Shiva speaks about this beautiful verse, Rama 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 Rama. He represents faith. He represents the process of having devotion in the heart. So when Brahma said you should marry Sati to Lord Shiva, he is actually talking about the marriage between Vishwas and Vichara, or Buddhi and Bhava. Because both are needed to give birth to devotion. Daksha couldn't handle it. And then we find the whole, you know, Daksha, Yajna happening. So there are two consequences to Buddhi. One is, you become doubtful of everything. I mean, you know, if you actually want to doubt, you can doubt everything in devotion service. You know, and not everything. How do you understand all certain concepts that are mentioned? Like for example, Shukadeva Goswami is parrot in the spiritual world. And how did he enter into his mother's womb, Ved Vyasa's wife? He just flew into a womb. It's a parrot running away from, you know, Lord Shiva was angry on him because Shukadeva heard Lord Shiva's conversation with Parvati, and he ran from Shiva and he straight entered the womb of his mother. And then he was born as a human being, you know. It's too much. What? Fake tale. It's too much, you know, speculation. So you can just keep analyzing every pastime. Putana, 12-mile long Rakshasi. When she fell, miles. What do you mean by 12-mile, you know? Mathura to Vrindavan distance is probably 12 miles. So she fell at Mathura, where it was in Mathura. So you keep analyzing so many things, you know. I mean, if you want, that's a problem in Buddhi. So one of the consequences of Buddhi is that you doubt everything. And the other possibility is that you use your Buddhi to reach the right conclusions. You can use your intelligence to analyze the truth very nicely and become firm on the principles. So Brahma indicates by marrying Shiva and Sati that one's buddhi should be surrendered to Vishwas, to faith. Now, just to give a symbolic representation, a symbolic understanding of all these chopping of three heads, just so that our buddhi is satisfied, you know, our intelligence is satisfied. The Puranas mentioned that Brahmaji had five heads. Padma Puran talks about this too. And out of which one of the heads is cut off by Lord Shiva. So there is a very unique ritual that Shiva starts by cutting off Brahmaji's head. So when it means to cut the head, what is it? What does it really talk about? It talks about eliminating the faults of buddhi. Eliminating the faults of intelligence. So Brahmaji, he created a very beautiful girl. And after he created that beautiful girl, he started running after her only. There are so many artists today who love their own creation. A writer loves his own work. A sculptor loves his own, you know, a sculpture. An artist falls in love with his own painting. You know. This is the problem. He started with Lord Brahma. He fell in love with his own creation. Or a preacher may become so obsessed with people he preaches to. You know. So essentially, buddhi, intelligence, creates some things, and instead of understanding that the creation is not mine, it's Krishna's creation, it's Krishna's intelligence, it's Krishna's skills manifesting through me, one starts thinking that it is mine, and for me to enjoy, for me to exploit. And therefore, Lord Shiva, he cut off the head of Lord Brahma, and the essence of that cutting of the head means that the attachment is removed. So after that, Brahmaji became free from his attachments to, you know, his own creation. So when when a father, you know, when a father gives birth to a child, or, you know, he's instrumental in giving birth to a child, the understanding is that that child is not his or her child, mother or father. It's God's child. It's manifested through me, through us. Similarly, any creation that is manifested through you has to be surrendered back to God. The moment you start saying that it is my creation, that's when the problems begin. I once went to a publishing house, and there they had one very interesting sofa, like a small chair, you know. And it was in a certain corner in that office set up. I was very inquisitive. I said, what's that chair doing there? They told me it's a thinking chair. You sit over there and you get ideas. I asked them, does it really happen? You sit there and you get ideas. Does it really happen like that? They said, no. In fact, we never get ideas after sitting there. Just see, human beings, they're so limited in their ability to analyze and think. It's, if really you are thinking, then you should get ideas when you want them. Unfortunately, you get ideas when you don't want them. In the bathroom, you know, or in the whole Eureka and all that stuff, you know. You get ideas when you don't want them. That means the ideas are not in your control. That means it's not your intelligence. It's not your buddhi. It is being manifested through you. It's God's intelligence. It's God's thinking, God's abilities that may manifest through you. Unfortunately, people in this world who are, caught by this buddhi cycle, they surrender their creation, instead of surrendering the creation to God, they surrender the creation on the altar of the false ego. And that's when the fifth head has to be cut off. That's what ego needs to be chopped off. Daksha was a ahankari. He was a very proud person. And he practically orchestrated the yajna, the Daksha yajna, to insult Lord Shiva only. So was called, I mean, they were not even called actually. Sati insisted that they come, and Lord Shiva just accompanied her, and the whole yajna, you know, he, Daksha only found faults with Lord Shiva, insulted him very, very badly. And then, when Lord Shiva cut off the head of Daksha, the demigods who were present over there, they started saying that, you have destroyed the purity of the yajna. And Lord Shiva made a very interesting statement. He said, how is it that the purity of the yajna is destroyed? In fact, the yajna is now completed. And the demigods were confused. What is the meaning of the yajna is now completed? Lord Shiva said, for a yajna to be completed, there has to be purna ahuti. The final ahuti, the final oblations that you pour, is the oblation of the false ego. So he said, by cutting off his head, I have, you know, offered the ahankar to the yajna guru. And then, of course, ahankar is one of the dosha, or the faults of buddhi, or faults of intelligence. So Daksha was given then the head of a goat. Now the head of the goat represents, I mean, who would want to have a head of a goat? Goat's head, first of all, so small. The capacity of the intelligence, you know, the brain behind inside it is naturally also so small. So Daksha retained all his intelligence and all his abilities, but he didn't retain the face of which he was so proud, because he was an extremely handsome man. And then the third cutting off the head represents the cutting off of Lord Ganesh's head. Parvati Devi instructed Lord Ganesh that not to allow anybody to enter the house when she is having a bath inside. So Ganesh even stopped Lord Shiva from entering, the owner of the house, from entering the house. He said, you can't enter without permission. I mean, can you imagine? Lord Shiva is the owner of the house, and Ganesh is saying over here, you can't enter. One time Krishna was in Vrindavan and he was caught stealing butter from a gopi's house. And the gopi asked him, why did you steal? And Krishna, he was very astonished and shocked. He said, oh, I thought this is my house. Behind this pastime, there is a very deep understanding. The deeper understanding is that Krishna is trying to say, the gopi is thinking it is your house, but actually all houses are my houses only. Krishna is the master, Krishna is the owner of everything in this world. We end up claiming a certain house, put a nameplate outside of it, and you know, we say, this is my house. It's actually Krishna's house. And when Krishna comes to his own house to steal his own things, it's not called stealing, it's his property. So here, Lord Shiva was trying to enter his own house, and Ganesh is saying, you can't enter without permission. But Shiva was saying, what kind of person is this? Buddhi, one of the qualities of Buddhi is to discriminate the right from wrong. If Buddhi cannot discriminate what is right, the idea is here that Lord Shiva came back to his own house. He doesn't need permission to enter his own house. And Ganesh, he was created by Parvati alone. She was not involved in the creation of Lord Ganesh at all. Parvati, you know, from the chandan of her body, she created Ganesh. So now, when you create something just on your own, as I said, Sati represents, you know, Parvati represents intelligence of Buddhi, right? And Shiva represents Vishwas of faith. So she has created Ganesh purely based on intelligence. So naturally, when intelligence is involved and there is no faith involved, the process of discrimination is very incomplete. You can't discriminate clearly what right from wrong. And therefore, what Lord Ganesh did was he purely acted out based on database. Database analysis. These are names that are there, these are names that are not there. Your name is not there too. There's no faith involved. There's no Vishwas involved. So generally, when we use pure buddhi, intelligence to analyze the pastime of the Lord, there's absolutely no question of our understanding even to discriminate what is right and what is wrong. And therefore, Lord Shiva cut off the head of Lord Ganesh. And then Parvati came and understood the mistake. And then Lord Shiva installed the head of an elephant. Now, an elephant's head, elephant, if you study from a practical point of view, but Prabhupada also would often say this, elephant is ignorance filled up. The whole body of the elephant is only ignorance, you know. Now, why did Lord Shiva install the head of an elephant on Ganesh? Because his whole body was made of intelligence. And there was some element where you need faith. By installing the head of an elephant, Lord Shiva indicated that now the process is complete. Buddhi combined with Vishwas, with faith, his contribution to Lord Ganesh. You know. So Shiva's Parvati's contribution to the body and Shiva's contribution to the head. You don't really need too much intelligence to analyze the process of Buddhi. What you need is simple faith. So, the process, what Srila Prabhupada is talking about in this purport here and in the translation that Kapil Muni is talking about, is what is it that differentiates a pure devotee, a liberated soul, from a conditioned soul like all of us? That faith in God, that Vishwas, that faith that a pure devotee has in Krishna's protection. That faith completely differentiates a pure devotee from a conditioned soul. This year happens to be the 1000th year of the 1000th anniversary of Ramanujacharya, who is one of the greatest saints and happened to appear in South India. So this is one very interesting story in Ramanujacharya's life that really brings out this quality of faith and how a devotee seeks Krishna's protection and has complete faith in Krishna's protection. So Yamunacharya was the guru of Ramanujacharya, who was like the head of the Sri Sampradaya. When he passed away, all the leaders of the Sri Sampradaya, they installed Ramanuja as the next successor. Practically, Yamunacharya was wanted that, and Ramanujacharya was the one who would actually understand Yamunacharya's heart. And but there were some people who were very envious of Ramanujacharya. Naturally, because he's a young man, such a powerful position, and these people are all much, much senior to him. So there was one person who was the head pujari of Sri Rangam, Ranganath temple. Now the head pujari was a very, very big position at that time. And he was a very senior disciple of Vimalacharya. So he was thinking, when such senior people are present, like Mahapurna and Goshtipurna and people like that, why is this young boy being made the head of the station for that? So he was very envious. And he decided, out of his envy, to actually kill Ramanujacharya. It's not that he was not a devotee. And it's not that he was acting just for a position. He was convinced he was actually doing welfare for Sri Sampradaya. Material energy can convince you of anything. Material energy can convince you that an offense is actually your defense of the Krishna conscious moment. There are so many people in this world today who are highly offensive towards devotees, but they are highly convinced that I am protecting this con. It's a fact. So here, the head pujari of Shiranam temple plotting to eliminate Ramanujan. So he called Ramanujan to his house for prasad. And he told his wife in the prasad to mix poison. Can you imagine? Prasad. So Ramanujacharya, he went to the house of his pujari. The pujari, of course, at that point of time, he had some service, so he couldn't be there. So he told his wife to serve him nicely and finish up the matter. So the wife, she was serving Ramanujacharya, her hands were shivering literally. So Ramanujacharya realized something is wrong. Finally, the wife just couldn't keep it in her mind. She told Ramanujacharya, "Don't eat this food, this has poison." So Ramanujacharya was completely shocked. Why would somebody want to poison a devotee? He just got up and left. This man came back, this pujari came back, and his wife told him, I'm sorry, I had to tell him. So his wife, he was very angry with her, and he chastised her, and then he said, "Don't worry, I'll take care of it myself." The next day, Ramanujacharya came for darshan to Ramanath temple. He was standing in front of the deities to have darshan. And this pujari, in the charanamrita of the Lord, he mixed poison. Can you imagine what extent envy can take you to? In the charanamrita of the Lord, he mixed poison. And when Ramanujacharya held out his hand to receive charanamrita, he was pouring it. Ramanujacharya knew this charanamrita is poison, but he offered it to Ramanath. He held it out in front of Ramanath and he said, "My dear Lord, I am drinking this charanamrita, the nectar that gives life." And he drank it. This pujari was very happy, waiting for the symptoms to manifest. And then as Ramanujacharya was walking away, he began to sweat profusely. His body began to tremble. And, his hairs were raising on the ends. Actually, Ramanujacharya was experiencing ecstatic symptoms. And the pujari was getting convinced that very soon he is going to collapse and die, He was waiting and waiting and waiting. Nothing is happening, And then that's when the pujari realized, this person is not an ordinary person. He's an exalted devotee that the Lord is personally protecting. And then this pujari realized his mistake, went and fell at the feet of Ramanujacharya and actually surrendered and became his disciple. So essentially, a devotee understands the mood of the Lord's protection. It's not just about intelligence, it's about faith. Ramanujacharya was one of the most intelligent people in the world. Kind of analysis of the Vedanta, Sri Bhashya that Ramanujacharya has written, is practically something that we can never understand also. Highly intelligent people, but at the same time, the kind of faith that they had. He had a disciple named Kuresh. He was a combination of him, buddhi and bhava. When Ramanujacharya wanted to write the Sri Bhashya, the commentary of Vedanta Sutra, he was searching for a manuscript which is called as a Bodhayan Vritti. And this particular manuscript was the manuscript that had every argument that the Mayavadis would use. So Ramanujacharya wanted a copy of the Bodhayan Vritti so that he can use it to counter the arguments. And the Bodhayan Vritti was available only in one place. This is in Kashmir, all the way in the north. There is a place called Sharda Peet. So Ramanujacharya and his disciple Kuresh went all the way to the north to find this Bodhayan Vritti. And in those times, there were no printing presses involved. So there was only one copy in the entire world of Bhagavad Gita that was there. So they went all the way, they asked the Maoists for the copy of Bhagavad Gita. They said, we don't have it. We lost it. And Ramachandra was very upset. Can you imagine going all the way from Srirangam to Kashmir, walking? And then after reaching over there, they say, we don't have it. So Ramachandra was very sad and dejected, and he slept in the night. In the dream, Saraswati Devi came in his dream and he said, the Bhagavad Gita is there. And he said, I have kept it. She said, I have kept it for you. You come and take it from me and run away. So Ramanacharya actually went to the temple and Saraswati held the Udayanmuthi in her hand. She actually gave it to Ramanacharya. So Ramanacharya took the Udayanmuthi, he and Kuresh ran away. They knew that these people were going to catch up with them. So they were trying to run away as fast as possible. Then at a certain point, the king of that land, he came to know that the Udayanmuthi is missing. So he sent his people, get the Udayanmuthi back before these people write a commentary on it. So, these people chased Ramanacharya and they found him after, almost a month of running away. They snatched the Bhagavad Gita and took it back. Ramanacharya was so disappointed. He hadn't even reached Srirangam. There was no question of him starting to write the Srivatsa commentary. There was no question of him having time to refer to the Bhagavad Gita because all day long they're traveling just to reach back. And now the Bhagavad Gita is lost. Kuresh, his disciple, he said, don't worry. I have had it over Bhagavad Gita. Can you imagine what intelligence? Ramanacharya said, how did you manage that? We were walking all day long. Kuresh said, while you were sleeping, I learned to hold Bhagavad Gita by heart. Can you imagine what kind of intelligence he had? And Kuresh, so he was so intelligent, so much he had learned, like photographic memory, just learned the whole thing. That Ramanacharya, as he was writing the Shri Bhashya, whenever he needed any reference, he would ask Kuresh, and Kuresh would just quote the exact words from the Bhagavad Gita and the exact place it was written. And that's how Ramanacharya and his disciple of his Kuresh, they wrote the entire Bhagavad Gita, the Shri Bhashya. So the essence is that this kind of combination of, and so Kuresh is personification of Buddhi and faith also. At a later point in his life, Kuresh actually gave up his life for the sake of Ramanacharya. Ramanacharya was escaping from a king named Kolatunga, who was a very, very envious king. And he wanted to kill Ramanacharya. So Kuresh, he exchanged his clothes with Ramanacharya. Kuresh was a grihastha. So he gave his white clothes to Ramanacharya, he wore Ramanacharya's saffron clothes. They looked a little similar also. So the king didn't understand the difference, and he actually blinded Kuresh. You can imagine. And then when Kuresh was blinded and Ramanacharya came to know that Kuresh sacrificed his vision for the sake of his spiritual master, he asked Kuresh, go to Varadaraj in Kanchipuram and ask him for your eyes. Kuresh went to Varadaraj and he said what he prayed for. He prayed to the Lord. He said, my dear Lord, my spiritual master has asked me to ask you something. So, Varadaraj said, please ask for anything. So, Kuresh, he couldn't ask anything for himself. He said, please forgive Kolatunga, this king who blinded him. Varadaraj, he said, of course he is forgiven, because the moment you desired it, he is forgiven. So, Ramanacharya heard, this is what he went and asked. He said, come on, I told you to ask my eyes back. Go and ask again. He went to Varadaraj again. And this time, again when Varadaraj asked for any benediction, Kuresh, again instead of asking for that, he said, my dear Lord, please bless all the devotees of your devotional service. He kept asking random things. Three, four times he was sent and he was asking these random things, not about. So then finally Ramanuja had to tell him, go to Varadaraj and ask him for your eyes, because your eyes don't belong to you. They belong to me. So this time when Kuresh went, he asked, Varadaraj said, ask for any benediction. And Kuresh said, my dear Lord, my spiritual master wants his property back. He's lost it some time back. Please return his property. And instantly Varadaraj gave his eyes back. And then Kuresh used his eyes serving his master, serving his Ramanacharya. Essentially, what does it teach us? It teaches us that Kuresh was personification of intelligence practically. Great amount of intelligence. Imagine learning the entire Gulam Prithi by heart. But at the same time, the kind of Vishwas, the kind of faith that he had in his Guru's instructions and in the Lord's protection. One time there was a devotee who asked Parashar Bhatta, exalted Vaishnava, that when Lord Ram was building the bridge across on the ocean, initially when Ram started building, before he started building, he was very angry at the ocean god. He was so angry that the ocean god was not coming to give him permission. He was practically going to burn the entire ocean, dry up the entire ocean. And suddenly the ocean god comes up and he begs forgiveness. And suddenly Ram becomes very happy with him and gives a blessing and all that. So this devotee's question was that how did the anger of Ram turn into love so suddenly? Parashar Bhatta, he gave a very interesting answer. He said, let me tell you a story. And he told a very interesting story. He said, one time there was a beggar who went to a very rich landlord. And this landlord was bald. Now, being bald is not so much a problem if you do it voluntarily. If it just happens involuntarily, it's definitely a big problem. It's a crisis, in fact. There's an entire department in medicine, dermatology, just based on, you know, this fear that people have of losing hair. There's something known as a pain of discipline, and then there's something known as a pain of regret. For most people, if they don't voluntarily go through a pain of discipline, they go through a pain of regret eventually, you know. So this beggar went to this rich landlord who was bald, and he went and glorified him. He said, oh, my dear landlord, you are so great. You have such beautiful hair on your head, you know. You look so beautiful with your hair on your head. So this landlord, he asked, why have you come over here? So this beggar, he said, I just came to glorify your beauty. The landlord became so happy, you know. He said, give him a bag of grains of rice. You know, big bag of rice he gave to the beggar. So beggar put this bag of rice and going back happily, you know. And on the way, he met one man. And this man asked him, how did you get this big bag of rice? He said, I got from the bald landlord, you know. So this man went to the landlord straight and he said, this beggar, you know, he's calling you bald. So the landlord got angry. He said, this fellow has fooled me. So he ran to take back that bag of rice from this beggar. Now he was running, this beggar started saying, he saw him and realized something has gone wrong. He started saying, oh my lord, please don't run, your beautiful hair are flying like anything, you know. The landlord came over there, he said, I'll come to give you one more bag of rice. He gave him a second bag. So Parashar Bhatta, he said, he told this story and he said, if a materialistic person can melt, his anger can melt in when he's praised, then what about the Supreme Lord? Therefore, when a devotee approaches the Supreme Lord, before he offers prayers, he offers glorification. If you study all of the Srimad Bhagavatam, if you study all the prayers of the Acharyas, if you study all the prayers to the Lord, the prayers begin with glorification first. Now, you might think that, you know, it's irrelevant. Come to the essence. The essence is that you're going to ask the Lord for something. Come to the essence, you know. No, that's not how it works. The way in which it works is, before coming to the essence, first glorify the Lord. And when you glorify the Lord's heart melts. And whatever you say, he says, okay, no problem. The devotee knows this secret. The devotee knows how exactly to handle the Lord's mood and what exactly the Lord wants, his desires, and how the Lord exactly thinks. And that's what we learned, the association of pure devotees. Probably, if we were not connected to the Hare Krishna movement, we, all of us know what we were and what kind of prayers we would offer. Most prayers were, more than prayers, were like wish-fulfilling desires. Like when people go to Tirupati Balaji and Siddhivinayak in Bombay and all these temples where lakhs and millions of people go every single day. Everyone has a big list in their pocket. Sometimes we go to Balaji temple. To have darshan of the deities, it takes you 24 hours, literally. 24 hours standing in the queue for darshan. People stand. And when they actually come in front of the deities, they get 1 or 2 seconds. Nothing more than that, literally. In front of the deities, have darshan. After 24 hours, when they get those 1 or 2 seconds of darshan, you know what they do 90% of the time? They're right in front of the deities, they close their eyes. Close their eyes. You know why? Because they don't want to miss out anything in that list. See the beauty of the Lord, they may forget something in the list. We don't want to see the Lord, we only want to narrate our list. So for most people, when they pray to the deities, when they pray to the Lord, it's just that they want to bring out their sense. The essence is that they want to ask for some meditation. That's it. But when a devotee praises the Lord, when a devotee prays to the Lord, he first goes into a lot of details. Glorifying the Lord's beauty, glorifying the Lord's greatness, glorifying the Lord's merciful nature. And then he speaks what he desires. When we go to a spiritual master, when we go to a guru, or when we go to great devotees, why do we go to them? For most people, when they go to great people, they go for mundane things. There are different relationships that you can have with a spiritual master. The first relationship that you can have with a spiritual master is artho artharthi relationship. That means you go to the spiritual master with some distress, problems. Or you go to the spiritual master seeking wealth. So that means for such people, they cultivate a relationship with the spiritual master which is just external. For them, Guru is their guide to prosperity. Guru is a counselor to solve their problems. Guru is a marriage counselor. Guru is a doctor. Guru is a networking person who helps them connect with other people who are, you know, financially rich and all that. So essentially, they go to a guru for all mundane things, material things, which have nothing to give and take with what the guru can really offer you. It's like, if you want to kill a mosquito, to kill a mosquito, you use a cannon bomb. What happens? Huge cannon bomb. Why do you need a cannon bomb to kill a mosquito? This is the time the mosquito dies, you know? So that's how we end up using the spiritual master. The spiritual master is like a cannon bomb. He can destroy your material life. But instead of that, you're using him to decorate your material life. That is the first relationship people have with the spiritual master. Artho and Artharthi. The second relationship, or the second type of relationship you have with the spiritual master is Gyani and Jidyasa. That means, you understand that the spiritual master, there's no physical dependency on the guru in that sense. We understand that the spiritual master is somebody who can illuminate our path to pure devotional service. So he is the person who can quench our spiritual thirst. I don't know if you have ever seen elephants eat. If you've ever seen an elephant eat, you'll understand this better. I mean, elephants cannot use their hands to eat. They don't have, they have four legs. So they use their trunk to put things into their mouth. Now, if you just have a trunk to put things in your mouth, and you stuff it in, elephants eat a lot, naturally. 150 kilos a day, that's the eating capacity. So when they are stuffing things into their mouth, naturally as they are biting, things fall off, right? So a lot of things go in, but a lot of things fall off also. But the amount of things that fall off their mouth is always negligible compared to the amount of things that go into their mouth. But the remnants of things that fall off the mouth of an elephant can feed millions of ants. Millions of ants survive on the crumbs that fall off from the mouth of an elephant. A spiritual master is like the elephant, relishing unlimited amount of Krishna katha and, you know, nectar of the holy name, nectar of Krishna's pastimes, and a few things spill out from his mouth. And those few things that spill out from a spiritual master's mouth, millions of ants like us can survive, you know, literally. ವರ್ಡ್ಸ್ ಆರ್ ಕಮ್ ಔಟ್ ಆಫ್ ದ ಮೌತ್ ಆಫ್ ಸ್ಕ್ರಿಪ್ಚರ್ ನಾಟ್ ಗುರುಮುಖ ಪದ್ಮವಾಕ್ಯ ಚಿತ್ತೇದ ಕವಿಯ ವಾಕ್ಯ. ದ ಹೋಲ್ ಅಂಡರ್ಸ್ಟ್ಯಾಂಡಿಂಗ್ ಇಸ್ ದಟ್ ದ ರಿಲೇಷನ್ಶಿಪ್ ಬಿಟ್ವೀನ್ ದ ಸ್ಪಿರಿಚುವಲ್ ಮಾಸ್ಟರ್ ಅಂಡ್ ಡಿಸೈಪಲ್ ಈಸ್ ಅ ರಿಲೇಷನ್ಶಿಪ್ ಆಫ್ ಬೇಸ್ಡ್ ಆನ್ ಕೃಷ್ಣ. ಸ್ಪಿರಿಚುವಲ್ ಮಾಸ್ಟರ್ ಕ್ಯಾನ್ ಆಕ್ಚುಲಿ ಗಿವ್ ಅಸ್ ಕೃಷ್ಣ. ಹಿಯರ್ ಆಸ್ ಇನ್ ದಿಸ್ ಪರ್ಪೋರ್ಟ್ ಆಸ್ ವಿ ಟಾಕಿಂಗ್ ಅಬೌಟ್ ದ ಸಿಚುವೇಶನ್ ಆಫ್ ಅ ಲಿಬರೇಟೆಡ್ ಸೋಲ್, ಅ ಲಿಬರೇಟೆಡ್ ಸೋಲ್ ಹ್ಯಾಸ್ ದಟ್ ಫೇತ್ ಇನ್ ಕೃಷ್ಣ ವಿಚ್ ಇಸ್ ವಾಟ್ ಡಿಫ್ರೆನ್ಶಿಯೇಟ್ಸ್ ಹಿಮ್ ಫ್ರಮ್ ಕಂಡೀಷನ್ ಸೋಲ್ಸ್ ಆಫ್ ದಿಸ್ ವರ್ಲ್ಡ್ ಫ್ರಮ್ ಆಲ್ ಆಫ್ ಅಸ್. ಅಂಡ್ ದೆರ್ಫೋರ್ as conditioned souls, we are so much conditioned to the bodily understanding. We need the association with the company of exalted people, the liberated souls, who have that kind of dependency on faith on Krishna. And by their association, we probably at some point in our lives also get to grow. If you study this particular Leela, the pastime of Samudra Manthan, the Samudra Manthan pastime has some very important things to teach us in this context that we are talking about. In the Samudra Manthan, the Lord asked the demons and the demigods to get the Mandrachal Parvat to use his churning rod. So, this the word Mandrachal is made up of two words, Mandar and Achal. Mandar is meaning Manthan, mantra, you know, it's churning. And the word achal, chal means move, and achal means that which does not move. So Mandrachal mountain is an immovable mountain practically. And now Mandrachal indicates our thoughts. Generally, thoughts of people are inflexible. Thoughts are rigid, you know. Most people, they cannot change their thinking. Very rigid type of thinking. Like when I try to preach to people, hours and hours of preaching also, just people don't understand on it. We do this course in Bombay called Journey of Self-Discovery, 6-session course, 12 hours, you know, of essence of the Gita. So many people come and attend this course. 12 hours a year, 15 hours a year, ask so many questions. But after all that, they still don't change. Their thoughts are just inflexible, you know. In India, we call this as HNS category. HNS means, how many is Udrenge? I will not change. No matter what you say, no matter how much you try, no matter how whatever you do to me, I will not change. So there are some people who come with that in the mind. Let's see how this world changes me. Yeah. With that kind of thought process, you can never really change. You know? Rigid thoughts. So Mandrachal mountain indicates that kind of thought process, inflexible. So now, if churning of the milk ocean has to happen, you cannot do churning with an inflexible, you know, mountain, right? You just cannot do anything to this mountain. So when they started the churning, when the Mandrachal mountain was kept on the ocean bed and the churning began, naturally nothing happened. In fact, the mountain started going down, started sinking down. Thoughts that are inflexible tend to sink, tend to take you downwards. These are called degrading thoughts. Yeah. They tend to take you lower in your consciousness. That is when Kurmadev appeared. And Kurmadev took the Mandrachal mountain on his back. So as soon as the mountain was on the back of Kurmadev, the journey could begin. The mountain started becoming flexible. That means your thoughts become flexible when they are based on Krishna. The moment you base your thoughts on God, on Krishna, the thoughts become flexible automatically. That means the moment you base your life on God, you center your life on God, the moment you allow your life to be held by God, your life becomes flexible, your thoughts become flexible, your actions become flexible, and you become flexible. Because the whole idea is, now you are ready to abide by the laws of God, abide by the direction of God. What is Gita? Gita is about Arjun beginning to use his intelligence, analyzing his own life. He had, like, if you study the first chapter of the Gita, 5 reasons why not to fight, 10 reasons why not to fight. So much analysis. At the end of all the analysis, second chapter, he comes to a paralysis. This is known as analysis by paralysis by analysis syndrome. There are so many people who are expert in analyzing their own life, but they become so analytical that they can just become paralyzed. And there was a caterpillar who was expert in dancing. He was really expert in dancing. So an ant came to the caterpillar and he asked him a question. The question that he asked the caterpillar was, how do you dance so well? Do you put your 100th leg before the 31st leg, or do you put your 41st leg before the 67th leg? The caterpillar got bewildered because he never analyzed so much. So the next time he danced, he started analyzing, you know. And he got so bewildered that he forgot how to dance. Paralysis to analysis syndrome, you know. So sometimes when so Arjuna was in that same situation, he's analyzing what happens if I do this, what if I do that, and at the end he realized, my dear Lord, Shishyas Deham Shadi Mamtam Vakandam. My dear Lord, I surrender to you, disciples surrender to you, you tell me what to do. And then Krishna speaks the whole Gita. At the end of the Gita, what is Arjuna's conclusion? You know, I'll do what you say. He's completely became flexible. So Arjuna's thought process, the Gita begins with inflexibility in thoughts and it ends with complete flexibility in thoughts. That's what spiritual life is, in a sense. The moment a devotee understands this, instantly the Lord becomes completely flexible to a devotee's desire. So when a devotee becomes flexible to the Lord's desire, the Lord becomes flexible to a devotee's desire. I'll end with one very interesting story that happened in Kanchipuram. This is a story of one temple which is one of the most amazing temples in Kanchipuram. It is known as Yathodkari Vishnu. There was a lady in Kanchipuram, very old lady, she was a 60-year-old lady, who used to draw rangoli, you know, the traditional paintings, floor, rice floor. So every day she would draw these beautiful designs for the pleasure of the Lord. But as she was getting older, her hands were becoming stiff. She wasn't able to actually do it anymore. So she went to one very exalted devotee whose name was Kadi Kannan. And she told him that, you know, my hands are becoming rigid, I'm just not able to do the seva to the Lord. This Kadi Kannan was such an exalted devotee. He had mystical powers. He just blessed her and he said, may you become young. And she instantly became a 16-year-old girl. And she continued doing her seva. The king of that land, he saw suddenly this lady has become young again, you know. So he was bewildered. He went to her and he said, how did you become so young again? This lady said, Kani Kandan, my guru, he blessed me and I became young. The king said, yeah, call him here, I also want to become young. The lady said, come on, you are a materialistic person, you have, what you have to do with pure devotional service? If you have any seva and if you have something, then probably my guru might bless you. But he will not bless you for enjoying yourself. He said, no, get him here. So Kani Kandan came over there and the king said, I'm the king of this land. I want to become young again. Bless me so I can become young. Kani Kandan said, I'm sorry. I don't give blessings like that unless you are really, you know, going to use that blessing for the service of the Lord. The king said, don't you understand? I'm the king of this land. I can do anything. I can make you do anything. Kani Kandan said, sorry. The king said, get out from my kingdom. Kani Kandan said, okay, he left. So, before leaving the kingdom, Kani Kandan went to his guru. His guru's name was Bhakti Sar. He was much more exalted personality. And he told Bhakti Sar that the king has asked me to get out from the kingdom. I'm going. Bhakti Sar, the guru, said, if you are going from the kingdom, what will I do over here? I'm also coming with you. So, the guru and disciple both were walking away. They went to Yathodkari Vishnu, this particular deity. And they went and told the deity that, my dear Lord, the king has asked us to get out from the kingdom, we are going. Yathodkari Vishnu, this lady said, what will I do if you are going? I will also come with you. So Bhakti Sara said, okay, wind up your bed and come with me. So the deity, Lord Vishnu, rolled up his snake by putting it under his arm. So seeing Yadavtari Vishnu walk away, all the deities of Kanchipuram, you know, Varadara, you know, Aragya, Nasinga, so many other deities, they all started walking along with. So practically, all the deities of Kanchipuram left, these exalted devotees left, and seeing them, all the devotees of Kanchipuram started leaving. And actually, when all these people left, the sun and the moon left. The sun didn't rise the next day morning, the moon didn't rise the next day morning, there were no stars also in the sky. The king was totally bewildered. What's going on? And then he realized Kanikandan and Bhaktisar left, so everyone left along with him. Then the king went running to Kanikandan and fell at his feet and begged forgiveness. He said, please come back. I don't want my youth, I don't want anything, just come back and stay in my kingdom. And then Bhaktisar, Kanikandan and all these people came back. And when Yadavtari Vishnu, he came back just to commemorate this particular event, this particular Leela. Yadavtari Vishnu from that day, he started keeping his head on the right side. Generally, Lord Vishnu, you find his head on the left side and his feet on the right side. This is the only temple in the world you find Lord Vishnu's head on the right side and feet on the left side. So he laid down the other way just to tell the world, for my devotee, I'll do anything. The word Yadavtari Vishnu in Sanskrit, in Tamil it is called Sollina Seiva Bhagavan. What it means is that this Lord will do anything his devotee tells him. If you tell him, get up, he'll get up. Sit, he'll sit. You know? So this is the nature of the Lord. So the Lord's nature is that he becomes flexible. Once a devotee becomes flexible in his thought process to serve Krishna. So first we have to develop flexibility in our thoughts. And then the moment we develop flexibility in our thoughts, Krishna develops flexibility in his thoughts, in serving us and assisting us in our devotional life. That's the essence of today's verse. Thank you very much, Hare Krishna. Any comments or questions? Yes.
Prabhuji, the idea, wife of Gautam, how she was blessed to be always young and very beautiful. So much so that Indra and God's son also came. So, do you know who blessed her?
Yeah, Ahalya was created by Lord Brahma also. And Brahmaji actually gave her that benediction of being extremely beautiful, and she was married to Gautam Rishi eventually. So Ahalya was Brahmaji's creation. Yes.
Hi Krishna Prabhuji. Thank you for this wonderful class. Even after such wonderful class, my intelligence is overpowered. The thing is, what is the optimum threshold until where we can use our intelligence in case there is a conflict between intelligence and faith?
So there is something known as reasonable faith. What we should, you know, there are two things, there is blind faith and there is reasonable faith. So what we are supposed to do, what we are supposed to practice our devotion with is known as reasonable faith. Blind faith means you just don't question, just do whatever is told to you. Most people, you know, practice devotion in any form, they follow what is known as blind faith. But reasonable faith means you use your logical intelligence to analyze to a certain extent. But beyond a certain extent, faith takes over. You use your intelligence and logic to come to the conclusion what is the right path for me to follow. But once you choose the right path, you use your intelligence sufficiently to choose the right path, then you allow faith to take over. That's the process. But if you keep on questioning the basic substances itself, then it's not going to progress. So you can use all your logic and all your intelligence till a certain point. Beyond a certain point, you should allow faith to take over. That's my understanding of it. So that means, till you come to the conclusion that this is the path that can give me perfection. You use all your intelligence, no problem. But once you decide that this is the path, then you don't use intelligence to micro understand that path. Because Chaitra Mahaprabhu, he gave three words which kind of form the substance of the whole Hare Krishna movement. Achintya Veda Veda Tattva. That is the essence of the entire, you know, process of Krishna consciousness. Achintya Veda Veda Tattva. Bheda means difference. Abheda means similarity. Simultaneous oneness and difference. Oneness in quality and difference in quantity. That means we and God are one in quality. Satchitananda Vigraha. We are also eternal full of knowledge of this. We are different in quantity. God is infinite and we are infinitesimal. But Chalamahabhu preceded this Veda Abhed by one word. Achintya. Achintya means inconceivable. So whenever you come across something that you don't understand, this word comes in help. Achintya. The moment you learn the word Achintya, you quit. Achintya means inconceivable. You're not supposed to understand it. So there are many things in spiritual life that are quantified, qualified, and explained by this one word, Achintya. What Achintya essentially means is that right now you're not qualified to understand it. In future, there may be a time when you may understand it. But till then, patience, peaceful, faith. Make sense?
Yes.
Yes.
Guru, you mentioned that we should be flexible in our thoughts. So can you just elaborate a bit more, like what do you exactly mean flexible?
Essentially, human beings like to do things as per a plan. This, then this, and then this, and then this. Because human beings prefer less surprises. Unfortunately, bhakti is all about surprises. Brahmaji, when he prays in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Tattena Kampam Sushabhikshamana Gunjani Avatam Kutam Vipaham. What does it mean? Kridva Bhakuri Yudhana Namaste. He's essentially saying, my dear Lord, whatever comes into my life, whether it's good or bad, I take it as your Anukampa, Tattena Anukampa. And then, how I take it? Hridva Bahu. In my heart, in my words, and in my body. I take it completely as your grace. Vinay, on an intellectual external level, a body level, we may say, okay, Krishna's mercy, no problem, let it come. There will be emotion. On a verbal level also, we may say, Prabhuji, Krishna is great, he is no merciful on me, he made me suffer. But in our heart, do we actually say that? That's why the problem is. So, when I'm talking about flexibility in thoughts, it really means that are we wanting to really be flexible to Krishna's plan, welcoming Krishna's plan, not just on a physical and verbal level, but also on a heartfelt level? That's what pure devotion service is about. Make sense? Anybody else? Mataji, any questions? Yes.
When we are preaching to people, sometimes they're so driven by the intelligence that as soon as the word faith or belief comes in, it straight away registers the blind faith or blind belief. So, is there a way to how you can cultivate faith through your intelligence?
The question is there a way to cultivate faith through intelligence? And when you preach to new people, when you connect to new people, most new people, the moment you say faith, they talk about, they think it is blind faith. So they prefer things to be intellectual and analytical. I'll tell you my experience of preaching. 99.9% of people who become devotees, who can connect to the Hare Krishna movement, they don't come because of anything. You know why they come? They come because of love. They come because somebody has really taken care of them. I don't think I've come with here because of philosophy. The best of philosophy is here. But actually what we really need, what human beings really need is love. Outside world has unlimited philosophy. If you look at the kind of books that are there in the market, there is unlimited hodgepodge, so much intellectual titillism, intellectual gymnastics, you know. What people really come to the Hare Krishna movement is not for that. What they come here for is for love. But that's missing there. We have the God of love here. That's something that is missing everywhere. Krishna dances. Krishna plays his flute. Krishna loves his devotees the way he connects. That's missing everywhere. So what people really come for is love. So my understanding of preaching is this. When people come initially in the Hare Krishna movement, you talk to them about a lot of logic and all that. Present philosophy in a very logical way. But along with that, along with the logical presentation of the philosophy, you need to give them unlimited amount of love. Unlimited amount of love and affection. That's really what it takes. I'll give you a story. One person used to come to the temple regularly, started coming. He come for Shayan Darshan in the night. And when the Shayan Darshan would get over, there was this pujari who was observing this person coming steadily. One day this pujari called him behind him, towards the altar room. And he gave him a glass of rabdi, condensed milk. This man, when he drank the glass of rabdi, condensed milk, he was completely bowled over. First of all, out of so many people, he was selected to give him the glass of rabdi. And second thing is, the glass of rabdi was pure nectar. He had never tasted anything like that ever before. This man, his heart melted. The next day, Pujari got him again. Again, gave him a glass of rabdi. This man was completely, he's so overwhelmed. This Pujari is not preaching to him some, intellectual stuff on yoga ladder and, four tattvas, nothing like that. He's just giving him a glass of rabdi, This man drank it. His heart was melting, After a few weeks of drinking rabdi like that, this man started chanting 16 rounds, had a foreign divided schools, everything that was told he was doing. And eventually he joined the temple for a few months and a year. And then he went back to the pujari for getting a glass of rabdi. The pujari told him, now you give to somebody else. Give this for all. Apparently that's what preaching is. Intellectual, yes, we need that. But actually people are not really looking for that. What people are looking for is love which is missing outside. So if devotees can give that, you don't really need to preach intellectually and all that. You can become devotees. This is my understanding. Very grateful to all of you for your patient listening and for enthusiastically being here. I'm very, very happy to serve you all and share something with you all. Whatever I spoke, if there is something that helped you all, it's my greatest pleasure. I spoke something that beyond my realization, please forgive me for that. Nutrashana Bhavatam Ki, Sri Prabhupada Ki.